Sudan, the army chief reinstates Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok after weeks of deadly unrest triggered by a coup. Firefight in the occupied Al-Quds. Israeli forces kill a Palestinian in a shooting that leaves one Israeli dead and two Israeli soldiers wounded. And Venezuelans head to the polls in local and regional elections. The opposition is also participating in the vote, breaking years of a boycott. Appreciate you being with us. Well, the first story this hour takes us to Sudan, where a potential breakthrough there is taking place to end the crisis triggered by last month's coup. Now, the military agrees to a deal that sees Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok reinstated and all political prisoners released. The deal was signed by military leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and Hamdok hours ago in Khartoum. It aims at restoring civilian transitional rule. Hamdok said he had agreed to the deal to stop the bloodshed. However, Sudan's main civilian opposition coalition and trade unions rejected the agreement. They're encouraging demonstrators to continue rallies against the military and the coup it staged on October the 25th. The latest such rally took place as the deal was being signed at the presidential palace. Security forces fired tear gas to disperse people from marching towards the building. At least 40 protesters have been killed in the military crackdown since the coup. Well, earlier, I discussed the latest developments in Sudan with political analyst Julius Mavala, too. Now, he says that country's military forces must realize that the nation will not submit to their rule.
The idea that the military overturned a transitional federal government makes it not trustworthy. It's not seen very much as a good custodian of change. And therefore, that's why forces of freedom and change, which is a major force in the opposition camp, has refused to recognize this agreement. And they say that this agreement cannot be trusted. They are calling upon protesters to carry on protesting relentlessly. What they want to see going away or gone forever is any military rulership and military coups. So that's where we are right now, a positive and a negative at the same time. But on the other hand, the idea that military has realized that it's kind of sandwiched, it's caught between a rock and a hard place. And the only way forward is to bring change about. It's a good opportunity for the military to just wake up and realize military rulership in Sudan is not desirable. It's not needed. People are hungry about it, and they'll never stop until they get democracy.
Israeli forces have shot dead a Palestinian in the old city of Al-Quds. Israeli military is alleging that two Palestinian men approached one of the gates of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. One of them then opened fire, killing an Israeli settler and wounding three other people, including two Israeli officers. The military says its forces immediately fired back and killed one of the Palestinian men on the spot. The other reportedly escaped. Palestinian resistance fronts are now reacting to the development, pouring praise for the move, calling for the struggle against the occupation to continue. Hamas says such operations are a natural response to the Israeli regime's growing crimes against Palestinians. Earlier, we spoke to our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, to get more information about the victim and the aftermath of the incident. Let's take a listen.
Well, the identity of this Palestinian man is known now. Fadi Abu Shkhedem, 42 years old, from the refugee camp of Shafat in occupied Al-Quds. Hamas movement, in its statement, said that Fadi Abu Shkhedem is one of its leaders in Shafat refugee camp. And now we are receiving that Israeli forces are on to the refugee camp of Shafat, it seems that they are planning to destroy the Fadi Abu Shahida. Israeli crimes and atrocities have never come to an end. Every Israelis raid West Bank areas, villages, cities, as well as areas in occupied Al-Quds. On a daily basis, they arrest Palestinians, and a number of Palestinians had been killed during peaceful demonstrations and protests against the illegal settlements and against the separation wall. So the Israeli forces continued their crimes, killing people, people, unarmed people, peaceful people. And it seems, according to experts, as they continue to say, Palestinians are fed up. They have the right to defend themselves, to defend their homes and lands, to defend also their children in order not to be arrested. Children under the age of 10 are being arrested in Al-Quds without any legal basis.
4 years ago today, Iranian top military commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, in a letter to Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, confirmed that the Daesh terror group had been fully eliminated, that after years of barbaric brutality and bloodshed committed by the group against the armies and the civilian population of Iraq and Syria. More in the following report.
The Daesh terror group, known mainly as the ISIS or ISIL in the Western world, was founded by Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi and became known internationally in 2014 after driving Iraqi security forces out of key cities in lightning attacks, followed by its capture of the strategic city of Mosul. For several years, the group carried out the most brutal attacks against civilians and government forces in both Iraq and Syria. Just to name a few, the Sinjar massacre, during which thousands of Yazidis were butchered, and the killing of more than 2,000 cadets and personnel at a military academy in Iraq's Tikrit. They also inflicted irreparable damage on Iraq's vital infrastructure. The savagery against the civilian populations was beginning to raise concerns in the international community about the situation in the two Arab countries. Several regional nations, including Iran, were already viewing Daesh as a national security threat. That prompted Iranian authorities to move to assign top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, to take on a military advisory role to help those countries eradicate the terror group. With the liberation of Abu Kamal, a Syrian city close to the border with Iraq that was the last stronghold held by Daesh terrorists, and the bringing down of the flag of the terrorist group and the raising of the flag of Syria, General Soleimani announced the termination of the rule of Daesh. In a letter sent to Iran's leader in November 2017, the commander outlined who had been behind the creation of the terror group.
All these crimes have been designed and implemented by U.S. leaders and organizations according to the acknowledgement of the highest-ranking U.S. official who is currently President of the United States. Moreover, this scheme is still being modified and implemented by current American leaders.
The Iranian commander also hailed Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Sistani for mobilizing all facilities to fight the scourge and praised resistance forces in Iraq and Syria for their role in defeating the terrorist group.
Certainly, the resistance of the Iraqi and Syrian governments and the perseverance of the armies and youth of these two countries, especially the highly popular mobilization forces and other Muslim youth from other countries with the prominent presence of Hezbollah led by its great leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, played an important role in overturning this dangerous event.
General Soleimani also acknowledged Iran's role in bringing the life of Daesh to an end.
Definitely the valuable role of the nation and the governments of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the respected president in particular, the parliament, the defense ministry, as well as police, military, and security organizations of our country in supporting the above-mentioned states and nations is admirable.
General Soleimani, along with commander of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, was assassinated in a U.S. drone strike in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, in January 2020 as part of a plot to remove a force against a group created by the U.S. and its allies to pursue their political goals in West Asia.
Continue with other news now this hour. People in Venezuela are heading to the polls in regional and municipal elections. The vote will choose more than 3,000 governors, mayors, and city council members across the country. Over 21 million people are eligible to cast their ballots. The opposition is also participating in the elections, breaking years of electoral boycott. President Nicolas Maduro and U.S.-backed opposition leader Juan Guaido have urged their supporters to vote. The elections are being observed by more than 130 international monitors, mostly from the European Union. That's the first such European mission in Venezuela since 2006. And it's also election day in Chile, where people there are casting their ballots to elect a new president from among seven candidates vying for the post. Nearly 15 million people are eligible to vote. The candidates cover the entire political spectrum from left to right. The favorites are leftist Gabriel Boric and far-right José Antonio Kast. Under the new president, Chile will draft the new constitution. People already selected members of the body in charge of drafting the new text in May of this year. A new constitution was the main demand of protests that rocked Chile in 2019. Chileans are complaining about what they see as inequality between the poor and rich. On Sunday, they will also choose members of the 155-seat Chamber of Deputies and almost two-thirds of the senators. Our correspondent Alejandro Kirk is president of one of the polling stations in downtown Santiago, the capital city of Chile. Now he explains how the voting is going on there in the country's presidential election.
The president, Sebastián Piñera, already voted early this morning. He is a very unpopular figure, and he is under judicial charges for corruption. And he called, notwithstanding, candidates to remember that they would be elected for the people, by the people, and serving the people was their duty, which sounds in this context a bit Pinteresque. It's early now to predict any outcome of this election. People here queuing to vote in this high school in downtown Santiago. But we have some results coming from abroad, from New Zealand, Australia, China, Korea. And in these results, we can see two things. First, a huge turnout, which was not the case in past elections, and also that the left-wing candidate Gabriel Boric seems to be overwhelmingly winning this election among voters in Chilean residents in those countries.
Russia hits back after the U.S. expresses concern over what it seems is a probable attack by Russia against its neighbor, Ukraine. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken expressed his worries about Russian activities on Saturday. He said those concerns are also shared by Europe and Ukraine. Washington and its allies are referring to what they see as unusual Russian troop movements near Ukraine. Moscow has already dismissed that. Instead, it is complaining about increasing military activity by the Western military alliance NATO near Russian borders. Moscow also says NATO should stop arming Ukraine with modern weapons. Moscow and the West have been at odds over Ukraine since unrest broke out in the eastern part of that country back in 2014. Britain's decision to blacklist the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas as a terrorist organization is sparking outrage and condemnation around the world. The move, which will be pushed in UK Parliament next week, could see Hamas supporters and activists face jail terms of up to 14 years.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is now designated as a terrorist organization by Britain following the Friday announcement of UK Home Secretary Priti Patel. The move brings Britain in line with the United States, which designated Hamas a terrorist group in 1995, and the European Union. UK Home Secretary, Priti Patel, justified the decision by arguing that it was not possible to distinguish Hamas's political and military wings. She claimed that Hamas has a significant terrorist capability and access to extensive and sophisticated weaponry. This is while the group uses its weapons to defend the Gaza Strip against Israeli aggression. Patel also highlighted the importance of a ban to protect the Jewish community. The British official, however, did not make any reference to Israel's deadly attacks against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The British Parliament will vote on the proposals next week. If Patel's bid succeeds, showing support for Hamas in Britain could be punished with up to 14 years in prison. Israel applauded the news, with its foreign minister, Yair Lapid, saying the move was a result of joint efforts between the British and Israeli regimes.
And, of course, it was all in cahoots with Washington as well. Apparently, the British Home Secretary, Priti Patel, who announced this decision, made the announcement in Washington, not even in London. So you can see the Israelis, the British, and the Americans were all involved in this.
The London's decision adds the political wing of Hamas to an existing ban on the movement's military wing, Al-Qassam Brigades. This move has drawn widespread condemnation. The Palestinian Authority says the UK took the measures at Israel's request, adding that it's an unjustified aggression against the Palestinians and will hamper reconstruction efforts in the besieged Gaza Strip. Iran has also denounced the British measures. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the Palestinians' rights cannot be trampled on by distorting facts. Hamas has slammed the UK's move as a crime against the Palestinian people.
The British Home Office's decision to consider Hamas a terrorist organization is a crime against our Palestinian people and all their history of a struggle, as well as a condemnation of the legitimate struggles of all free peoples against colonialism. This decision, if implemented, is considered a great political, moral, and legal sin committed by Britain, in addition to its first crime of establishing the Zionist entity and making the Balfour Declaration.
Hamas's spokesman said Britain's move encourages the Israeli regime to continue its atrocities against Palestinians.
And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Florida's version of the American dream, which holds that even people of relatively modest means can aspire to live near the water, depends on a few crucial components: sugar white beaches, soft ocean breezes, and federal flood insurance that is heavily subsidized. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Christopher Favell. The piece is titled, "The Cost of Insuring Expensive Waterfront Homes is About to Skyrocket." Florida's version of the American dream, which holds that even people of relatively modest means can aspire to live near the water, depends on a few crucial components: sugar white beaches, soft ocean breezes, and federal flood insurance that is heavily subsidized. But starting on 1st of October, communities in Florida and elsewhere around the country will see those subsidies begin to disappear in a nationwide experiment in trying to adapt to climate change, forcing Americans to pay something closer to the real cost of their flood risk, which is rising as the planet warms. While the program also covers homes around the country, the pain will be most acutely felt in coastal communities throughout the United States. For the first time, the new rates will also take into account the size of a home, so that large houses by the ocean could see an especially big jump in insurance rates. Federal officials say the goal is fairness and also getting homeowners to understand the extent of the risk that they face and perhaps move to safer ground, reducing the human and financial toll of disasters. Subsidized insurance has been critical for supporting coastal real estate market, said Benjamin Keyes, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Removing that subsidy, he said, is likely to affect where Americans build houses and how much people will pay for them. It's going to require a major rethink about coastal living in the United States. The government's new approach threatens home values, perhaps nowhere as intensely as in Florida, a state which is particularly exposed to rising seas and worsening hurricanes. In some parts of the state, the cost of flood insurance will eventually increase tenfold, according to data obtained by the New York Times. For example, Jennifer Zales, a real estate agent who lives in Tampa, Florida, pays $480 a year for flood insurance. But under the new system, her insurance rate will eventually reach $7,147, according to Jake Holhouse, her insurance agent. And that is prompting lawmakers from both parties to line up to block the new rates, which will be phased in over several years. "We're extremely concerned about the administration's decision to proceed," Senator Bob Menendez, a New Jersey Democrat, and eight other senators from both political parties, including the majority leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, wrote in a letter on Wednesday, 22nd of September, to Deanne Criswell, the administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. Created by Congress in 1968, the National Flood Insurance Program is the primary provider of flood coverage, which often isn't available from private insurers. The program is funded by premiums from policyholders, but can borrow money from the Federal Treasury to cover claims. The average annual premium is $739. Until now, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, which runs the program, has priced flood insurance based largely on whether a home is inside the so-called 100-year floodplain, land expected to flood during a major storm. But that distinction ignores threats like intense rainfall or a property's proximity to water. Many homeowners pay rates that understate their true risk. The result has been a program that subsidizes wealthier coastal residents at the expense of homeowners further inland, who are more often people of color or low income. As climate change makes flooding worse, using tax dollars to underwrite waterfront mansions has become increasingly hard to defend. In 2019, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, said it would instead price flood insurance based on the particular risk facing each individual property, a change the agency called Risk Rating 2.0. After a delay by the Trump administration, the new system takes effect next month for people purchasing flood insurance. For existing customers, rates will rise starting next April. The change has won applause from a grab bag of advocacy groups, including climate resilience experts, environmentalists, the insurance industry, and the budget watchdog group Taxpayers for Common Sense. With a rapidly escalating threat of natural disasters, Risk Rating 2.0 is a much-needed and timely change, said Laura Lightbody of Pew Charitable Trust, which has pushed governments to better respond to climate threats. Higher insurance costs, she said, were a reflection of our new wet reality. The rate hikes around Tampa Bay in Florida are unusual, according to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. Most homeowners will see much smaller increases to their insurance bill, and many will experience a decrease, the first time in the history of the program, the agency said. As for those who may be forced from their homes by rising insurance rates, the agency noted that it has long urged Congress to offer financial help to lower-income residents, a more targeted type of assistance than simply subsidizing policies for most homeowners, regardless of their income. For the first time, our policyholder premiums will be based on their individual risk, said David Morstad, who runs the flood insurance program at FEMA. We pledge to continue to evaluate and make adjustments where and when it's warranted, David Morstad said. Lawmakers have responded to the change with alarm. Last week, 38 members of Congress signed a letter urging House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to block the change. We are concerned about the burden of potential double-digit rate hikes on our constituents by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA's untested pricing methodology, the letter read, calling that burden too much for them to bear. Unlike current climate policy debates, which tend to break along partisan lines, views on flood insurance are less a matter of political ideology than of geography. All but three of the members who signed the House letter represent coastal states, including five Republican lawmakers from Louisiana and all 10 Democratic House members from New Jersey. The letter was signed by 19 Democrats, including some, such as Grace Meng and Richie Torres of New York, who in other contexts have stressed the need to address the effects of climate change. Neither Grace Meng or Richie Torres responded to requests for comment. Charlie Crist, the former Republican governor of Florida, who now represents St. Petersburg as a Democrat in the House of Representatives, also signed last week's letter. He rejected the Federal Emergency Management Agency's argument that higher insurance costs would serve to alert people to the risk that they face. That's one of the most inhumane, callous statements they could possibly make, Charlie Crist said. We're going to punish you so you know what's going on. In the past, insurance policy has been vulnerable to political pressure. In 2012, Congress rolled back some of the subsidies in the flood insurance program, only to reverse course just 2 years later after voters objected to higher insurance costs. But the growing threat of climate change may make that kind of intervention less successful, said Roy Wright, who ran the flood insurance program until 2018 and now runs the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety. We cannot hide the truth of this increasing risk, Roy Wright said. We shouldn't hide it. We should tell people the truth.
Welcome back to Aperture. The illegal recycling of electronics is a toxic business on a global scale. Every year, 3/4 of electronic waste from Europe and the U.S. disappears from official recycling system and is shipped illegally to India, China, or Africa. In the first part of the documentary, we took you on an investigative journey through Africa, China, Europe, and the U.S. in an effort to unravel the out-of-control corrupt systems enabling illegal e-waste recycling. Stay with us as we further investigate to reveal the apparatus of large-scale trafficking as well as a complex chain of responsibility and collusion in the next part of the program.
The U.S. is the only country in the world, apart from Haiti, that has not ratified the Basel Convention, the international agreement banning the export of toxic waste. To make matters worse, the U.S. government itself is as bad as anyone else when it comes to recycling its own discarded equipment.
The U.S. government is the single biggest producer of electronic waste on the planet.
Discarded electronics of whole departments are routinely put out to public auction instead of being sent to trustworthy recyclers.
Whoever gives the government the best rate, in other words, they can take it for free or almost for free, the government is kind of obliged to do that because in our laws you're supposed to go the cheapest way to save the taxpayer money. But the cheapest way is the dirtiest way.
Recyclers who do actually recycle find themselves the target of shady exporters. Plant manager Craig Lorch has been in the business for more than 20 years.
We get regular requests from brokers that are in other countries looking to buy materials, buying computers, metals, laptops, anything with valuable materials in them. We don't sell to them. We don't know what they're going to do with the materials. We don't know where it's going to go.
Craig is part of a minority of conscientious recyclers who collaborate with Jim Puckett and the Basel Action Network. But many U.S. recyclers do export. The Basel Action Network estimates that between 20 and 50 e-waste containers leave U.S. harbors every day. To find out where exactly U.S. e-waste is exported to, Jim came up with a very effective spying technique.
We will just go around to these people calling themselves recyclers, and you drive by them, and the beauty is that you can't hide a big old 40-foot container. So it's very easy to photograph them, and they have prominent numbers, and we take pictures of those, and we date them.
Jim then goes online to find out where the e-waste containers are headed.
I can type that number into a database called TrackTrace, and here we see the whole record of that particular container in its last week's voyages. It's gone from Thailand to Singapore, now it's in New Zealand.
Analyze analyzing the main trading routes for U.S. e-waste, Jim made a surprising discovery.
It comes through Hong Kong almost 65% of the time from the U.S. We didn't know that until we started tracking and tracking and tracking. Wow, they're all going to Hong Kong.
The third largest port in the world, and any e-waste sent by the U.S. to Asia enters through here. But why isn't it seized and returned straight to sender? Containers arrive here every single day on merchant ships of all shapes and sizes. Vincent Wong oversees the customs team at the harbor. The biggest terminal, Kwai Sing, receives nearly 50,000 containers a day. Up to 100 of them are estimated to contain e-waste. Tracking them down is a challenge.
Hong Kong is a free port. That means that the ship and the cargo don't have to declare to customs at the point of entry right away, except they are demanded by customs officers. They only need to declare after 14 days, within 14 days of the import or export of a consignment.
This means that by the time Wong and his colleagues receive the customs declaration, the cargo has usually long moved on. To combat this loophole, the customs inspectors pull out any containers which ring an alarm bell. For instance, because of the company's history or a tip-off from abroad, and submit them to an X-ray scan.
We can scan a container truck in less than 2 minutes, the whole truck, and then if necessary, we'll open the container for further inspection.
E-waste has its very own shape and look under an X-ray scanner. Items like computer monitors stand out clearly.
For e-waste, we have quite a number of cases in the past few years, and most of them are declared as plastic scrap or metal scrap.
Up to 36,000 e-waste containers are estimated to enter through Hong Kong Harbor every year, enough to fill 20 of the largest cargo ships. About 40 containers a year are intercepted, sent back, and their owners prosecuted.
We do not process each and every container coming or going out of Hong Kong. Around the world, there's no one custom administration that can process 100% of them.
As a result, there are always containers that escape the authorities. Chinese activists are trying to find out what happens to them.
I always want to do something to make some change. So I joined Greenpeace since 2002. The first campaign is working on the e-waste.
Lai Yun is investigating how the e-waste containers slipping through the controls at Hong Kong get to mainland China. Just north of Hong Kong Island in the New Territories, there is a perfect hiding place for e-waste in transit. Lai Yun has come to pick up the trail.
I heard about a lot of e-waste from the overseas, like United States, coming to Hong Kong.
He soon finds a storage yard. The e-waste shipments await transport over the border. And since the storage of e-waste is not illegal, the authorities are turning a blind eye. There are dozens of yards in this area. The site contains everything from TV sets to monitors and computers. If these, as usually claimed on customs declarations, were really exported as usable second-hand goods, they wouldn't be sitting out in the open air in the rain.
I think that China and the United States are so important, work together to solve the e-waste problem. This is an international issue.
From the storage yards, the e-waste is smuggled across the border into mainland China. It's just a few miles away, but it's illegal.
The trucks reload in new territories and drive across very close, and they have to pay a bribe. It's the only way they could get across. Or you use a small coaster boat and go up the Pearl River Delta into areas like Nanhai. And there, again, you pay a bribe to unload it.
Once the e-waste has crossed the border, it travels to places like the town of Guiyu.
When we went to the Guiyu, we don't see any signs to say, okay, this is Guiyu, but we just smell, very strong the smell. Okay, we know we arrived at Guiyu.
Guiyu is one of many Chinese towns and villages where illegal e-waste recycling is happening on an industrial scale. Of the population are involved, processing millions of tons of e-waste a year with the connivance of the industrialized nations. The owners of the yards buy the waste abroad for peanuts, then recycle it using cheap labor. No money is spent treating the toxic leftovers or protecting the workers, so an item can be recycled for a tenth of the cost charged in Europe or the US. As opposed to the African dump sites, in Guiyu, there is a division of labor.
Very typical local family workshop. The workers also recycle the plastic or CRT. This guy used the light to burn the plastic and classify different types.
Separating different kinds of plastic by burning and smelling them is a cheap and effective technique, but it damages the lungs. Another family workshop specializes in recovering minute amounts of gold by dipping motherboards into acid baths. The workers are risking cancer by breathing in the toxic smoke. Afterwards, the remaining acid is simply dumped in the river. The groundwater has also been polluted, and even a simple cup of tea is laced with toxins. The constant exposure to substances such as PCBs, lead, and mercury is causing numerous health problems, including nerve and brain damage, skin diseases, and a rise in birth defects.
Really what's happening is people are externalizing costs. You don't want to solve the problem, you'd rather let someone else deal with it, and you'll never have to pay for it. You don't ever get a bill from China saying, you contaminated my land, you have to pay.
China's factories in the neighboring provinces, for instance in Shanghai, Yangzhou, and Guangdong, immediately buy up any recycled materials, such as copper, aluminium, iron, gold, and plastics. But e-waste recycling is not only about selling scrap materials. An even more lucrative business is the recycling of computer chips. In clandestine workshops, transistors, integrated circuits, and other components are taken off discarded motherboards. The harvested parts are sorted and cleaned and sold as brand new components for the production of new electronics. This trade is said to be worth 100 billion euros a year, but it carries a huge risk that has an impact all over the globe, wherever computer chips are a part of our lives. For instance, in trains, planes, cars, nuclear power plants, hospitals, in short, everywhere. The companies who build the control systems for this kind of equipment are finding it increasingly difficult to distinguish between new chips and refurbished ones, and to be sure that their products on which many lives depend are safe. For TQ Systems in Germany, this is a daily challenge. Since the original label has been painted over, it's hard to know which type of chip it really is. Clues pointing to the origin of a chip on the scrap heap are broken and missing pins, or labeling that has been scratched off with a crude and blunt instrument. If the chips were sold as new, they should have come from a factory like this facility in Dresden, where new chips are produced in a highly controlled environment. But the scratched surfaces point to a different origin. Guiyu, or another e-waste recycling village somewhere in the developing world, and this means that the chips might be damaged. Major chip manufacturers have started to employ investigators to keep tabs on the situation.
We're currently investigating investigating a case where a customer had purchased from the open market a power module. They introduced them into a public transportation system, and after 1 month of usage, they exploded.
The module had burnt out inside. Stephen Jetta and his team found out that it had been fraudulently relabeled with a higher temperature resistance, probably because a high resistance fetches a better price.
You can imagine if you have a power module that's originally developed in an environment where maximum voltage is 1200 voltage, and it's been remarked in 2400 voltage, it's not going to last.
TQ Systems have decided to check every single batch of chips on arrival using a special X-ray system. Time and effort to find out if the skewed connection is harmless or likely to cause a malfunction. Mike is back in Ghana and observing a steady stream of containers arriving from all over the world. Why do the Ghanaian authorities not seize the e-waste on arrival and only let in the functional second-hand goods? A young Ghanaian investigator, Anas Arameyo, has some answers. Anas always works undercover and has never shown his face in public. He recently took his hidden camera to Tema Harbour, Ghana's main port.
E-waste was one of the biggest areas that we looked into. For example, most fraud happened through the e-waste system. Customs have a form of valuation for such home appliances or goods, and the valuation is next to nothing. Somebody goes to clear used goods from the West, and they will look at it as condemned goods, so you're not going to pay the value that you would pay ordinarily.
At Tema Harbour, no one is really interested in separating working goods from waste. Everything is declared as waste and let in virtually tax-free, with the help of a bribe, or a little present for the customs officers.
In many of my footage, you see the service officers walking through the e-waste. First of all, they themselves start picking some that they think is useful.
Then the importers sell the material. The working items go to the second-hand market, the rest to the scrap dealers. For the buyers, it's a gamble, as up to 90% can be broken or in need of repairs.
There was nothing like anybody's going to check the efficacy. In fact, at the sales point, you are told that this is it. It may have a fault or not. For example, if you take about 30 of them, the ones that will be working will be about 2 or 3. But then the people who buy also rely on doing some repair work on it.
The items that work or can be repaired go on sale in the streets of Accra.
Majority of Ghanaians, about 90% of Ghanaians, would want to depend on these second-hand equipment. So there are new phones, there are new laptops, but it is still expensive and people don't have the money to afford these things.
The second-hand market is thriving. A functional 10-year-old computer siphoned off the recycling system in Europe or the US trades for 25 euros upwards. But there is a big problem with imported second-hand equipment. Often it has only a very short lifespan left.
We should control not only the waste, but the near end of life equipment, so things that become waste really quickly.
Ghana doesn't have any recycling facilities, so any equipment coming into the country, be it e-waste to be scrapped, new electronics, or second-hand imports, sooner or later ends up on a dump site. Ironically, many of the old appliances will have been officially charged to the recycling system in Europe before being exported. But The ones doing the actual recycling work are a group of kids who eke out a living selling the small amounts of metal they can recover. This can hardly be called efficient recycling. All this raises a seemingly naive question. Given that when we buy a new computer in Europe, its recycling is included in the purchase price, shouldn't this money end up with the person doing the actual recycling, wherever they may be on the planet? If European e-waste continues to go abroad, shouldn't the European recycling system be extended and used to set up modern recycling plants in places like Ghana? Or what about a totally different approach? While harbor controls failed to prevent the e-waste from entering, while broken electronics are traded freely on the internet, while e-waste travels the seas by the container load, while Europe and the US won't stop the ships from leaving, while recycling facilities in Europe are leaking like sieves to shady brokers, we need to remember who is at the start of the e-waste chain. The consumer. Few of us can resist the latest gadgets, and we have got into the habit of constantly replacing them with the latest model after a very short time. Last year, worldwide, nearly 50 million flat panel TV sets were sold, 300 million PCs, and 2 billion mobiles and smartphones. Sales figures for consumer electronics are constantly on the rise, and not only in Europe, but also in emerging markets such as India, China, and Africa. Maybe it's time to redefine our roles as consumers and start using our gadgets for a longer time, before the entire planet is littered with discarded appliances that have a long and toxic life ahead of them as e-waste.
Perhaps it's important for the consumers to be aware of how overconsumption and subsequent illegal dumping causes suffering to other human beings across the globe. Perhaps this will lead to more responsible choices, but the bottom line is that governments in the EU and the US must take full responsibility by putting better regulations and systems in place. This toxic tide plaguing the world cannot be stopped while so many governments in the developed world are willing to turn a blind eye. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.